For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. 2020 has been an extraordinary year so far, not least because of the Black Lives Matter movement, which has had a resurgence since the killing of George Floyd on the 25th of May. We have also seen the renewal of the Closing the Gap Agreement at the end of July. Associate Professor Chelsea Bond is Principal Research Fellow in the School of Social Sciences at the University of Queensland. She and her colleagues have written a perspective for the MJA. I spoke with Chelsea back in March this year about whether it was time to call time on Closing the Gap. She's back today to talk about why the new agreement can be seen as disappointing at the least. Does it change anything?
No, well, I wrote a piece in The Conversation last week about that, and I think it probably, in fact, I think I would have gone harder had the Close the Gap had come out before writing that piece, because it's worse than what we thought, I think.
In what way?
I watched the press conference as well as read the full agreement.
Yes.
And even the language offers no reassurance, because it's actually a rehashing of the same old discourse in Indigenous affairs that has failed to deliver anything of real substantive change for Indigenous peoples. So it was actually even, from my mind, it was even more disappointing that in this Black Lives Matter moment that we would be offered something so appalling as this. Where do I start? The way in which, you know, this new partnership agreement, because it was new, was touted as though it must be good.
Yes.
And that it was the first, so therefore it must be good. But when you look at the detail, what we've seen is not an ambitious plan for closing the gap. In fact, we saw an abandonment of parity in this new agreement.
In what sense?
Like, they literally abandoned parity as the outcome. We see instead in the targets a 15% reduction or a decrease, but not parity. Now, this is after 12 years of a failed policy framework. Not only do we get more of the same, we get offered less than. And the only innovative part about it, it would appear, is that Indigenous peak bodies have signed off to it. And, that's really disappointing for me.
Are they signing off on it because there's been a kind of varnish of Aboriginal lead? Now that the Aboriginal communities have been put in charge, we can kind of just go, well, that must be better.
Yeah, well, I can't speak for the Peaks and all of the agencies that have signed off on this, and not all Indigenous organisations have signed off on this.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we have to acknowledge that. From what I read in the partnership agreement, I see no evidence of Indigenous peoples being in charge. There was a consultation process of which Indigenous peoples could contribute to the conversation in regards to the type of agreements.
Yes.
Type of targets.
Yes.
But even then, there are those who participated in those consultations who were deeply dissatisfied with the process and didn't get a sense that they were being listened to, rather they were being told about. There is no sense of where, the ultimate kicker, I looked at the language of the agreement and the language that was used in the press conference and the language that was then reproduced within the reporting, which in itself is problematic, because what we're seeing in Indigenous affairs right now is a reporting of the press release statements rather than an investigation into what the government's claiming it's doing. And so blackfellas are, we're suffering as a result of the media not doing its job, as a result of health professionals not doing their job, or public intellectuals not doing their jobs when it comes to Indigenous affairs, scrutinising it in the way in which we scrutinise other decision-making processes of government. But there's no sense in any of it that Indigenous peoples are in control in any meaningful way. And of all the buzzwords, of all the words around, you know, partnership and mutual responsibility and ambitious targets, the one word that was missing was sovereignty. Now, if we're going to talk about Indigenous peoples being in control, then how does that word not appear in the 47 pages and the press release? There's no sense that Indigenous peoples are in control. And in fact, the partnership agreement really sets a framework for data collection. And if you look at the drivers, supposedly, of these targets, most of it rests with the behaviours of blackfellas, not the six system structures or processes that produce these racialized inequalities. So we have an agreement that we've signed up to, apparently, that all it does, different from the last decade or so of failure, is it enables the government to blame Indigenous peoples, both the Peaks and both the blacks on the streets. that the failure and the ongoing Aboriginal problem is because Aboriginal people are the problem. If we forget Indigenous sovereignty as part of the framework in Indigenous social policy, then it's a different kind of conversation we're having. There's a different kind of scrutiny around systems and structures that will affect meaningful change. And so I think that's the real disheartening thing about this whole agreement and the conversation around it, is that we're supposed to be celebrating this, just like we're supposed to be celebrating Australia Day on the 26th of January. It's an insult. And yet it's like we're the ones that apparently just haven't got it yet. And this is in a global Black Lives Matter movement where we're seeing across the world some major change and structural changes taking place, and here it's not happening.
Yeah, I should explain to the listeners that you've written a perspective for the MJA that is as strong as you've been already in this podcast. I mean, one of the sentences I that really caught my eye was, "What is needed is an Australian health system that has a steadfast commitment to Black lives, not as in need of saving, but as deserving of care." That's language that you don't hear from the system itself.
No. The system's really happy to talk about discharge against medical advice.
Yes.
And non-compliance.
Yes.
And health literacy, you know, fixing the problem of Indigenous peoples by fixing Indigenous peoples or surveilling Indigenous peoples, or even, you know, health promotion, rousing Indigenous peoples for not knowing better and not doing better. But the system refuses to look at itself. And we see that even in, the end stage, the worst stage of not caring is we can see that in the coronial inquiries into the preventable and avoidable deaths of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the health system right now, in the period of closing the gap. And, you know, it's very hard to access those coronial inquiries of deaths in the health system, but they're there and they tell a story. And it's just so hard to read these accounts of mums and unborn babies who could be here with us right now if the health system cared. And that even when there's an inquiry into those deaths, that the recommendations that are generated, there still is no response and there's no requirement to respond to those recommendations or implement them. So to hear the talk about Black Lives Matter, we're still saying where and when.
You know there's going to be a very predictable response to your article and and this podcast.
Yes, so it's not my first rodeo.
No, exactly right. Yeah, and I know every time we do a story in Insight about Indigenous health, and I'm not resiling from any responsibility we have for using the same language that you're objecting to. We're on a learning curve ourselves. But we always get these comments from doctors saying, "I'm not a racist, I treat everyone who walks in the door exactly the same way, and I'm not going to change the way I treat black fellas because that's what I do. I'm just treating the illness," and that there's no racism in Australian healthcare.
That's a leap. It's a big jump, isn't it?
Yeah. You've suggested that we should forget about closing the gap and have, as you say in your perspective, a health justice framework.
Yeah.
What does that look like?
So if I can just step back a second.
Sure.
So in terms of the way in which systemic racism works is that it doesn't require independent racists or bad actors. It's that the system is working as it should.
Yes.
That the system is producing these. And so, and this is, I think, what critical race theory has to offer health and the health sciences, is to move beyond this is racism as a matter of how I think or feel about Indigenous peoples.
Yes.
It's about how our social world is structured in a way that ensures that Indigenous peoples die earlier of conditions that no one else does, because this society was founded upon our non-existence. And until we attend to that, even though we had the Mabo decision, I mean, my daughter in a high school assignment this year, as part of history, they got to debate the Mabo decision as to whether it was controversial. So we see that in this system, there is still this unease with the idea that Indigenous sovereignty has never been ceded. Now, if we cling to this idea, the ideology of terra nullius, and refuse to recognise Indigenous sovereignty, then as a society, we'll continue to produce outcomes that prove that logic to be true, and that is that we're not here.
Yeah.
And that's the reality of the world that we're living in. We live in a society that ensures that we die earlier of things that no one else does. And we're supposed to celebrate over a decade of policy failure that's committed to another decade of policy failure. Like, that's how violent this place is, not just in terms of health outcomes, but to the psyche of blackfellas that yes. were meant to accept this as being okay. For me, looking at addressing health inequality, it's not about reproducing the racialized logics that actually sustain the production of those yeah. racialized outcomes. What it means is we recognize that Indigenous peoples have a right to live. And yeah. if we worked on that framework, that we have a right to live, that we are deserving of care, then we would surveil different things. We wouldn't look at discharge against medical advice. We'd compare waiting times in emergency rooms. We would surveil the system to find out and diagnose how the system is working to produce these racialized outcomes. But nowhere in the Closing the Gap National Agreement that we've just seen is there a sense of that. And it's telling because of what you when you read the agreement, they have in there that as one of the reform areas is around transforming government. And as a subset of that, they mention, addressing a structural racism. But their approach to it is, and it literally says, getting Indigenous peoples into the mainstream and Indigenous peoples on boards.
Yeah.
So even when they have a conversation in that 47-page report with a little bit of a mention of structural racism, who's responsible for it? Apparently Indigenous peoples just need to be there in order to change it.
I'm speaking today with Chelsea Bond, a Mununjali and South Sea Islander woman. Chelsea's co-authored perspective can be found at mja.com.au, where it is open access. If you want to read the full Closing the Gap report, you can find it at ctgreport.niaa.gov.au. If you'd like to listen to our earlier podcast with Chelsea, you can find it and all our other podcasts at mja.com.au/podcasts. Back to our chat.
And Cornel West said recently, this idea of black faces in white spaces is not a strategy that works. And we only have to look at the first Indigenous doctors and the first Indigenous ophthalmologists. It doesn't do away with racism. It actually highlights how it's operating. And that experience is violent against the blackfellas. And not doesn't transform the system. It may moderate it a little bit, but we saw how Ransco behaved when they were called out for the racism within their profession. We saw the silencing. And to this day, all of a sudden, you can't read any of the articles in relation to this in the magazine. They've just silenced that whole conversation. Yeah, I think if we actually engaged intellectually with what racism is and how race functions rather than emotionally with how we feel about it and how we feel about being asked to speak about racism,
yes,
we would have a much better strategy. So this is not about guilt and about feelings. This is about structures and systems and its violence. And if we are committed to black lives, we'd be committed to then properly addressing, well, diagnosing the problem properly. Doctors pride themselves on it, and so we're clearly, we've got the wrong diagnosis here. So, of course, we're giving the wrong treatment. If it worked, we would have seen change by now. What's been interesting in terms of, 20 years working in health and public health and health service delivery and health research is the ill health that Indigenous people's experience is not because we don't know what's best for our health.
Yes.
And I still am doing my undergrad degree with predominantly Indigenous peoples of varying ages, and I learnt more from my fellow students than I did the lecturers.
Yep.
But in all of my, wherever I've worked, there is much more to learn from Indigenous peoples about health and survival than there is the Australian health system. Because for a long time, the Australian health system remained indifferent to the deaths of Indigenous peoples. Investment in Indigenous health by the state is still relatively recent. We're looking post-1970s. Up until that time, there was complete silence about decline our population, and the health system alibied this racist theories of a dying race.
Yeah,
it alibied it. And so when you speak to blackfellas in all different kinds of community contexts, blackfellas will tell you how these racialized outcomes are produced. Even when I used to teach in health sciences and try and explain to students the social determinant, trying to get health science students to understand the social determinants is a task. But I tell you what, in my community of Inala, which is the poorest, least educated community, black fellas here can explain to you in a very simple way how the social determinants work, because we feel it upon our bodies every day and everywhere. And so I think this idea that, you know, racialized outcomes are because there's something wrong with us, that we're inferior, is another myth that we have to challenge, is that Indigenous peoples know best about survival in this place, because, I don't know, we've been here 60,000 years. We've had to survive all kinds of things. And you know, and I think I always say this, that you go to a black protest and you will always see a sign that says, still here.
Yeah.
We are still boasting about the fact that we know how to survive, even amongst all this, the violence we've had to endure. And I think, so if we just at some point accepted that maybe Indigenous peoples have something to offer the health system in doing health better, not just for us but for everybody. It'd be amazing, you know, what we could do. But there's just this refusal to see that there's any expertise that Indigenous people have to offer, even amongst those of us who, you know, have undergrad and postgrad degrees in public health. I don't sit in a public health school. I don't even sit in a health faculty. So you see where our expertise gets sidelined.
Yes,
and marginalised. I mean, I don't even sit in my school on the floor of the building. And so this refusal to recognise Indigenous capability, Indigenous sovereignty, is an everyday experience that we have. And yet we bring an evidence base, a knowledge to this place, about this place, that the state remains indifferent to. Even when you log out of Facebook, you still have to sit in the tea room.
Yeah.
You still have to sit in the staff meetings.
Yeah.
There's no escape from this racial violence. And that's what I love about black fellas, is this steadfast refusal to give up in amongst it all. And I guess that's what we tried to do with this article, is to recognise the strength of Indigenous people. And, you know, I couldn't write about Black Lives Matter without actually writing from a place in which black fellas are screaming Black Lives Matter. And that's why we centered Kevin's Yayi's testimony at the rally, was to capture the beauty and the strength and the determination of black fellas in this moment. You know, this is not about this sort of unbridled irrational anger. This is a fierce determination and a love for black people, and a commitment and to the idea that black fellas deserve better. This is our home. And what really, I guess, what's frustrating about the health space, having been indoctrinated into it and having worked in it, is there's so much talk about care. But where is that for black fellas? And that's all mob are asking for. Even the mob that fight for a coronial inquiry into the premature death of their loved one, they're not wanting revenge. They're fighting to get a coronial inquiry so that the system will look at itself and not do that to another person.
Yeah.
Black or white. And so there's just a love that black people have, that there's much to learn from. And how do we then take up that, the beauty of that love and that strength in this moment, actually do justice to the idea of care? What does it mean to care every day in the course of our work, whether we're a researcher looking at the behaviours of pregnant mothers? How are we caring about them in the course of doing that work? Are we demonising them or caring for them? Mm. You know, whether it's the policy officer who maintains the status quo, and maybe sometimes it's from a sitting at the table, we've got to speak up because we care. And so I just wonder how we might embody this notion of care that we can see from black fellas in this moment.
How would you do that?
Well, I try and do it every day by yes, centering and honoring black people, and also caring for black fellas. You know, there are a lot of black fellas that work in the space of Indigenous health who are encountering all kinds of racial violence in the workplace. So sometimes in health, we think about attending to racism as something out there. You know, the racist taunts on a sporting field. But every day, everywhere, in all kinds of locations within the Australian health system, there are Indigenous people who are working fiercely to make a difference to the health of our people, who are having to encounter racial violence and having to quit and leave workplaces, or finding a way to survive in the workplace that is meant to be caring for Indigenous peoples. As we're seeing more and more Indigenous peoples enter into the health workforce, we're seeing more and more testimonies come out.
Yes.
From the nurses, the midwives, the ophthalmologists, the yep. medical doctors. There's more to come. And that's the one thing that I think was really powerful about the Black Lives Matter moment for Black people, was it gave people a sense of courage to speak up about the stuff that they had remained silent about, and typically because a lot of people insisted they stay quiet about it. Don't be a troublemaker. Don't be one of those angry ones. And so in my work around race and health, it's not about appealing to white people to see us as human. I'm not doing that anymore. And yeah. I used to do that. And I'm not trying to convince them of our humanity by talking about our strengths, because this is more than about strength-based approach versus deficits-based approach. This is about dealing with the violence of race in this place. My labour now is exhausted primarily and almost exclusively on blackfellas,
yeah.
supporting blackfellas to understand the violence that's being visited upon their bodies and helping them develop strategies for fighting it and seeking some form of justice, whether they are clients or whether they are clinicians.
The word violence is what I know will jack up a lot of white doctors reading this, because they're not seeing that what they're doing is inflicting violence.
They don't sit at the kitchen tables of black men and yep. black women who cry in front of their children, because despite all their best efforts, they've come to the realisation that the people around them that are getting paid very well to supposedly improve Indigenous health outcomes actually don't care about Indigenous peoples. And, you know, when we leave our homes, we armour ourselves up and we have to prepare for battle. But if you've been raised in a black home, you know the violence of race, because mm-hmm. it always takes a place at the kitchen table. And for those who discount it, it's, you know, that's shame. There's a reason why we're dying. There's a reason why our mob are killing ourselves at such high rates.
Yep.
There's a reason why we have high blood pressure. The black body is suffering the brutality of this place every day, even the educated ones, even the poor ones, even, you know, like it doesn't matter how good we are or how compliant we are, we will still encounter racial violence in the everyday places. And I speak about violence not just as the bruises that are inflicted upon our bodies, mm-hmm. But the wounds upon our souls of having to live in a world that's still predicated upon us not being here. If there are health professionals that by themselves fighting with Indigenous peoples because of the testimonies we offer, that in itself says something about how caring that professional really is. So thank you for caring.
Well, you know.
And it's great to see the MJA give a space for this conversation.
Exactly.
Because once upon a time we would not have been able to have this conversation.
No, thank you. I'm glad we're doing it, and I want to keep doing it as much as we can, because we have to.
Absolutely. And we're not going to stop speaking about it either. So.
Good. Fabulous.
Thank you so much.
Battle on. My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.